had a chance to settle in a little bit. If you're comfortable where you are, go ahead and stay there. If you want to be someplace else for the second, for the next part, feel free to move. As I was saying at the very beginning, I consider this part of the Eightfold Path to be an important transition. If you look at the Eightfold Path as we did early on, as being broken up in possibly into three sections, with the first one being the wisdom section where we talk, where we address right view and right intention, that's sort of a can also be seen as a place for getting our orientation on what this gradual training process is about. The second section, which is a section on ethics that we're just coming to the end of now, basically right speech, right action, and right livelihood, is sort of about setting the conditions for being able to practice. Because if you don't achieve those things in your life, if you can't start creating a world in which there isn't a great deal of distraction, where there isn't, you're not doing things that are overtly unwholesome, such as the various things that these ethical things talk about, killing, stealing, taking advantage of people and so forth, you're never going to settle down into being able to work with your mind and able to work with what you're trying to do to start escaping the pain and suffering that can be, that the Buddha was interested in eliminating. And now we're kind of coming into the third section, which is, in my interpretation of a lot of this, where it starts to be where we really start to do things that are very different than a lot of the other traditions might have you do. Things like the ethics, not stealing, not killing, those are pretty much common to all traditions. As we move in the Buddhist path into mind training, though, we're moving into the place where the Buddha was teaching people how to move beyond suffering and into liberation. But one of the things I found in things like the Eightfold Path here is if you just go along and you take each of these factors, the factor of right view, the factor of intention stuff, sometimes it's hard to see the bigger picture, the thing that ties all this together, in the midst of all of these, each of these factors. Now, each factor is a very valuable and powerful thing, but and they're all at play at all time as we walk this path, but there's a reason, somewhat of a reason to the order, and there is somewhat a reason as to what we're trying to do as a process of gradual training. And if you don't see the larger picture that's taking place here, sometimes it's a little bit hard to see what is how these things fit into his larger view of what's going on. So I'm going to take my part of today and not so much focus on right effort, which is what the subject is today, but I'm also going to step back a little bit, or maybe out a little bit from that, and try and go back and look at the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, but more importantly, what is the overall structure to this? What's the umbrella that kind of ties these together? And to do that, I'm going to step a little bit out of just the topics that we've got here. I'm going to look at some of the other topics in the Pali Canon. The Pali Canon is the Theravada version of the writings of the Buddha. Tipitaka, Pitaka, and generally in all the traditions, that's divided into three sections. There's the Vinaya, which is for the monks. It's basically the rules and laws. And you'll find that most of those were, in fact, sort of like judgments, case judgments. Something would happen in the Sangha. The Buddha would be forced to make a decision on a particular case. And so what you'll see in there is typically they'll tell you the story of why the Buddha had to make this decision, what his decision was, and what the rule for the Sangha going forward was going to be to do that. Usually as lay people, we don't get mixed up with that too much. So a lot of the times when I quote, or when I'm talking of stories from the Pali Canon, I will be talking from the Sutta Pitaka, which is basically the stories, the teachings, the dialogues of both the Buddha and some of his followers as they went forward. And that's I like those because I like the stories. I like all of that. But there's a third section which also comes in here, which is the Abhidhamma. And typically that is much less talked about, but I think all of you need to know that all three parts of this are there. The Abhidhamma has a couple of different origin stories. In accordance with a lot of Buddhist traditions, there's usually a mythological origin story, and then there's a historical origin story. So I'll sort of give you two alternatives on both, an alternative on both of those. In the mythological origin story, it said that the Buddha, towards the end of his life, felt it wasn't quite, the Sangha wasn't quite ready for some of the teachings and some of the information that he had. So he ascended into one of the higher heavens where his mother had been reincarnated, and he taught there these teachings of the Abhidhamma. And later on, after his passing, they were brought back and added to the Pali Canon as teachings. So they do occur in the Sutta Pitaka, and they are teachings of his according to that, and they are directly from him but brought back later. The historical perspective, which people who get to know me find that I usually prefer, is built around an understanding a little bit about what society and the structure of the world was like then. At that time, there was no writing in that part of India. And so as I'm pretty sure most of you have been told, much of the tradition of Buddhism has been passed on orally. That creates some problems. I mean, I have, you know, a stack of notes here that I'm doing, but they're really notes for me. If any of you were to pick these up and try and extract my talk back, the talk I'm giving you today back out of these notes, you wouldn't find it. Because what these generally are for me is little prompts here and there of the things that I want to touch on. And the only way then they get expanded into what I'm really telling you today and the way we're doing this is because I know this material. And so they're prompts for me to go the places that I need to go. And a lot of the writings in Buddhism that were transmitted down orally had to be the same type of thing, because there was no way without a written system you could ever develop things like we do today. You know, we have thousands of books, we have all of this analysis, people can go on for pages and pages taking apart a topic and so forth. If you're going to memorize that and pass it down from generation to generation accurately, you're not going to be able to work with that volume of material. So what you have to rely on is a very concise set of compressed notes about what the important things are, and then people's memories and ability to extemporaneously expand those. And so a lot of the times, if you go into the Pali Canon, if you go in particularly to some of these things, you will find that's exactly what's happening there. And that's why, for example, if you take Right Effort, which we're doing now, it comes down to four things. The Buddha's comments on Right Effort is, what monks is Right Effort? There is a case where a monk generates desire, endeavors, activates, persistence, upholds, and exerts his intent for the sake of non-arising of evil, unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen. Two, he generates desires, endeavors, activates, persistence, upholds, and exerts his intent for the sake of abandonment of evil, unskillful qualities that have arisen. Three, he generates desires, endeavors, activates, persistence, and upholds and exerts his intent for the sake of arising of qualities that have, of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen. And four, he generates desires, endeavors, activates, persistence, and upholds and exerts his intent for the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, and culmination of skillful abilities that have arisen. That, monks, is called Right Effort. Now, if you were just to take that without any explanation, it would be very difficult, I think, for anyone to do it. So that's the importance of putting all of this stuff into perspective. So basically, he's defining right effort as encouraging wholesome qualities in the mind, encouraging wholesome mental states, and discouraging, unwholesome, and unhelpful mental states. But there's actually a much larger psychology that goes behind that, and that's what I was talking about, the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma came later because it came basically in the period when you started having writing. And the monastics and so forth that came afterwards began to analyze and also began to be able to put down a lot of things that, rather than them being transmitted as these type of compressed notes, they in fact would teach to people. And I want to talk a little bit about that because that's kind of the umbrella into which a lot of this stuff fits. And that's really, so I don't know how many of you have encountered this stuff before. Some of you probably have and some of you probably haven't. There's no way I can go into it in great detail for what we're doing here, so I'm sort of just going to give you an overview, and I'll throw out some terms. There's no reason to even memorize those terms, but I think the fact that if you haven't heard them before, they're Pali terms, and if you haven't heard them before, at least next time you encounter them, you'll kind of know where they fit into this, of the Abhidhamma. And one of the ideas that the Buddha and Buddhism has put down has to do with what the nature of all of this is, what the nature of our experience is. Now recognize this was a period of time long ago, before science existed in the West, before there was much in the way of mathematics, analytics, much of anything else. So are these necessarily absolute truths about the real world? They're truths about the experiences the Buddha had and the understanding of his experience of the real world. So there are some people who would take the Abhidhamma and say this is absolutely true, you know. And there are some people who would say that it's not, that it's really the experiences trying to put down the truths of what's going on in terms of what they knew and what they had and what they understood at that time. And I'm happy to do it in that way. That's generally the way I take it. And I think they're truths that are absolutely still true today. So I don't see a problem with that, but they're not scientific truths. They're experiential truths. And one of the ways that he then took apart the experience of having a world was to break it into a little bit different set of things than we're used to working with. He broke it into what are called the skandhas. And these are the various parts of our world of experience. And he broke it into five of them. The first of these is rupa, which he called form, which is close to what we would call matter. It's not necessarily, it also includes other things besides, you know, this book. There are other components to that, but basically it's the things that are out there. It's the things that you and I can see and agree upon that exist in that world. Then he has a set of that is basic mental objects, internal mental objects, and I want to go into this a little bit further because it has relevance to what we're talking about in right effort here. So those are the things that are much more internal. They're the things that I infer exist in you, your emotions, your sensations. But these are things as human beings we share, and in fact, as some of the things that go on, such as sensory perception and this type of thing, we share with other living beings, sentient beings that are not human. But we still have to infer it. There's no way I can see what you see. There's no way I can feel the emotions you feel. I know I believe you have them, just as I assume you believe I have them. So rupa is what we can both agree on out there. Then we have these internal characteristics and mental objects. And then he has an absolute reality, which is nibbana, which he says can be experienced. I have to admit, I have never experienced, but I have no reason to assume that it doesn't exist. So then this is an absolute reality. This, one of the things that the Buddha says comes out of what we're doing here is the ability to experience and touch that absolute reality of nirvana. Okay? But I think it's important to understand how we perceive the world and how we build our world. For the Buddha, we do not really live and experience in the material world. We live and experience in a world that we fabricate, that we create. These are the skandhas. These are the mental, what are generally in Buddhism called mental formations. And they arise, they're linked into the world. They're linked into our experience of everything that's going on. When I see something, I obviously, what the Buddhism would say is happening is that perception, whether it's sight or a sound or it's smell or whatever, that enters through a sensory door. And those doors are the doors of sana, they call sana. They for each of the sensory things that enter from the real world, there's a mental process that takes place in me that creates a mental object in my internal world that I experience. And equally importantly, I will react to that. If it's an extremely bright light, I'm going to feel it's going to make me uncomfortable. It's going to make me somewhat painful. If it's something that I find very soothing, I'm going to get a certain amount of enjoyment out of it. And that's extremely important because when we start putting all these sensations and so forth together, we're building a mental construction of the world. And it's not just a mental construction of what we see and what we hear, but what we feel. Because with everything I see out there, everything I encounter out there, I'm also encountering an emotional reaction to it. And in Buddhism, those are called the Vedanas. And they're usually seen as, on one side, as being dukkha. And that's dukkha in its full Buddhist sense, from absolute intense pain and suffering up to just mild discomfort. But it's anything we don't like. And our natural reaction to that is to not want it, because anything that's uncomfortable, we don't want. On the other side of that coin, Buddhism puts forth the property of sukha, which is the opposite. It's the things that come from just mild comfort up to intense ecstasy. And so you have this overriding spectrum of everything that you experience will carry an emotional quality from the dukkha side through a neutral center to a pleasant. And for the Buddha, these had natural, they were tied to natural emotions in us. When we encounter things we don't like, we tend to push them away. We tend to become averse to them. When we find things that we do like, we tend to want to pull them in and repeat the experience of them. So these then are the things that have the tendency to create desire, craving, and wanting. Now, you would have no control over the fact that anything you experience, you're going to have a reaction to. I mean, that's below the level of consciousness, that's below the level of anything you can do. But when you experience those things, those are really at a very low level, and you are then going to start putting those things together to start constructing the bigger world that you experience. Okay, those are what, like I said, Buddhism would call the skandhas. Those are the mental formations. Those are the everything you experience that you're putting together. There's a consciousness there that sees all this, but there's so much coming in so quickly, and you not only have what you experience, but you also have your reactions to what you experience. You have your past. You remember all these things. You've identified all these things. Some things have burned you in the past. Some things have been great in the past. And so not only do you have the immediate reaction to what you're experiencing, but you also have your reaction from your history, your memory. These are basically the elements of karma. As you start experiencing things, you start making choices about what you're going to pay attention to, what you're not going to pay attention to, what you're going to pursue, and what you're not going to pursue. And this is all a choice area. You know, you there's so much coming in, there's so much happening, you can't pay attention to everything. So you start making choices based on your past experience, based on your karma, based on your habits, based on all these other types of things. And that is your world, then, is a world that's built up by choice. And it's important that it's built up by choice because it means you don't necessarily have to make the same choices going forward. And so what the Buddha is starting to do when he's starting into right effort is starting to give you instructions as to how you start changing what your world actually is. You know, it almost sounds strange that you should say, okay, you get to choose the world you live in, but it is also true because there's so much world out there and you are making those choices about which parts of it you're going to pay attention to, which parts you're going to pursue, what you're going to react to, what you're not. Now, some of it, as I say, is past experience. Some of it you don't control, but a lot of it you do. So you're fabricating the world you exist in. So the Buddha's instructions here on right effort that he's starting to put forth are ones that say you, in fact, can make those choices, but you require certain things. If you just run on habit, if you just let these things automatically, because when I was a child, I got, you know, I had a really bad experience with whatever, so every time I encounter that again, I'm going to have that bad experience, you have no ability to make a choice because you're running totally on habit power. But what he is saying here in right effort is, if you will pay attention, or if you can pay attention to what's arising in your mind, and that requires the ability to be mindful of what's actually happening in this moment, and it also requires the skill of being able to move your attention, move your consciousness to specific objects and keep it there long enough to see what's happening without being pushed away by your own habits, without being pushed away by your own emotions, if you can keep it there long enough to see what's happening, to see what the consequences are, you can start making choices and you can start determining which of these mind states do I want to pursue and which ones I don't. So the expansion of what he's saying that I read earlier in the condensed form is that you have all of these abilities, that you can acquire all of these abilities, and if you do, and you start using, and you start being aware of what's happening in your mind, and you start choosing which mind states you want to encourage, that you want to discourage the ones that lead to anger, lead to violence, lead to these things, because you know that they're not wholesome for you, they're not going to be wholesome for your neighbors, they're not the ones that are going to lead to your long-term happiness, and you're going to want to encourage the things that do lead to those types of states of mind, that if you will do that, what happens over time is the mind states and the experiences that lead to dukkha will start occurring less and less in this world that you're living in and constructing. They're not just occurring, they're not just doing it because you're deluding yourself that they no longer can see, you put blinders on, but they're doing it because you're starting to create a world that's then feeding back into the world you're living in. If you're generous to your neighbor is more likely to be generous to you. If you're harmful to your neighbor, they're more likely to be harmful to you. So by starting to encourage within yourself these mind states that are wholesome, these mind states that lead to more happiness for yourself and those around you, you're starting to change, you're actually starting to reconstruct the world you live in so that it is one that has less dukkha, more sukha, more calmness, more generosity, all of these types of things. And so the first step on that then is if we're training, if we're starting to learn how to do these things and trying to do these things, is to become aware of when these wholesome mind states arise, to become aware of when the unwholesome mind states arise. And if an unwholesome mind state has arisen, to stop it, to not let it become that which is driving the fabrication of the world we live in. You know, and also when you start seeing mind states arising of enjoying things, being happy, being generous, finding things that work, that if these are there, to encourage them, because then they start to drive the processes of fabrication of the world we live in. And so we have to train ourselves into doing this if we want to change the life and the world that we're presently living in. And when we do that, we change the life and the world for everyone around us as well. So practice is not just for us, but it is this gradual training process of doing this type of thing in order to accomplish those changes. Are there questions? I mean, I know I'm throwing an awful lot out here and I'm condensing it a lot and it's somewhat superficial, but I know different people come from different backgrounds here with different amounts of information of what they know. So are there questions about what I've said so far, or am I being clear as to this to me is the umbrella, because this is why right action is important. It's not just because you're going to be a good citizen if you do right action, but it's because you start creating a world that you can live in that is more pleasant for yourself. It's a way of driving dukkha out. And what happens over time is dukkha becomes less and less prominent in your mental states, in your life, and everything. Sukha starts becoming more and more prominent. And in fact, the Buddha accomplishes what he was after, which is the driving out of the mind states that create dukkha and the encouragement of the mind states that lead to much more happiness in the world, in yourself, and everything else. And but it's a gradual transformation. It's not I've suddenly seen this absolute reality and now I am transformed. But rather what you're doing is you're transforming how you work in the world, how your mind works in the world, what you see, what you experience, what you know. And the world somehow, that with so much suffering, just starts to fade and disappear. And this other world starts to dominate more and more in your life. But it takes effort. It takes knowing what's coming up in your mind. It takes working on those things, sometimes pushing those things away you don't want, sometimes encouraging those things you do. So are there questions? Or yeah.
So I can understand the need to see what's arising and to let go of the dukkha side.
Mm-hmm.
But if one wants to encourage the sukha, how is that not grasping?
I'm not sure that you're encouraging sukha. What you're encouraging is the mindsets that lead to sukha. If, for example, let's take dukkha for a second. If I am prone to getting angry, okay? Anger is a very tumultuous emotion for me. It's very likely to trigger those around me and to react very strongly. What I choose to do is I choose to look and I notice in my mind, anger is arising here. I'm not going to do that and I'm not going to express it intentionally. I haven't necessarily gone after sukha, but the result of that will be over time that sukha will be more and more present, because I'm driving out the mind state myself that causes that discomfort and tumultuousness. I'm driving out that mind state that's going to make G unhappy when I start yelling at him, and he's going to yell back at me. And so what I do is I start getting sukha without necessarily chasing sukha. The same thing is true on the positive side. If I notice in myself that when I help people I love, it makes me happy by being generous to them, or even if I help somebody who I don't know very well, but I realize that by helping that person's life is going to be better today, and that kind of gives me a good feeling. And I start saying, well, I think I will intentionally do that more often, because in being generous, I feel better. Then I start getting more and more of that aspect in my life without necessarily pursuing that particular feeling, because what I'm doing is encouraging the mind state that leads to that feeling. Does that make sense? Yeah, you don't want to go after the particular feeling. You can't create the feeling. You can only create the mind states that lead to that they encourage those feelings arising. You want to add anything?
I'll just say that you're creating conditions that support sukha. You're not grabbing it, but you're setting a field that will. It's like being a farmer, you know, creating the conditions for the crop to grow.
Well, I'm just thinking it's not like walking through the world with rose-colored glasses that, you know, Rome is burning and I'm smiling and being happy. I guess there's you bring more to it than just, you know, seeing Rome burn. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's why among the poisons you have, you know, if you have aversion and craving, those are poisons. But delusion and ignorance are also there. Because you can't afford delusion and ignorance. If you do that, that's the blinder world. And that will not take you away from suffering either. So that's why a lot of times there will be the advice when you're doing meditating and something uncomfortable rises, they tell you, don't push it away. You know, don't fight with it, just sit with it. Try and be present with it without working with it, because you don't want to encourage happiness through ignorance. Happiness through ignorance doesn't work either. So, yeah.
No matter what, I will be blessed.
Yeah, exactly. But there are strategies that even in the middle of difficult times, you don't have to suffer, because you've cultivated the stability of emotion, the stability of understanding what you can and can't do, that allows you not to suffer. It doesn't mean that you won't feel pain or be sympathetic to the pain of others, but you don't have to suffer for it. It doesn't have to become your way of life, this, you know, this awful whatever it is around you. Any other? Okay, well, I'm going to leave it there unless, since there are no other questions. Let's see. How are we doing on time? Am I?
Yeah, we have 2:20 for the breakout session one.
Okay, and we're a little past that. So, let's do a short breakout session anyway, and see what I can do here. Okay, let's do. I think the easiest one to do quickly is sort of doing the popcorn style. If you remember, I did this once before where. In your small groups, instead of having some few minutes to talk to each other, you're going to focus on and come up with one idea and make a comment into the common pool of the group for that, and then pass on to the next person, and you'll go around like this. And I think what I want to do as far as that is concerned is I want to think a little bit about coming to situations with from the standpoint of, I was talking about habit here, driving things, which is kind of there's different ways of looking at habit. Habit sometimes is good and habit sometimes is bad. Habit sometimes we describe as someone who has practiced something to the point where they're very skillful at it, they don't have to think. I mean, an athlete, for example, is a good example of someone who has developed a very skillful habit, something that when they bring to it, because they've done it so many times and they're not interfering with themselves, they can do it with great skill. Sometimes through habit, though, if you're in habit of fighting with your in-laws all the time, every time they want to talk about politics, and there's no thinking, there's no anything of it, can tend to be either useless or even harmful. So having habit, having these preconceived ideas of how you approach something is neither good nor bad. It's one of these things that we seek the middle way on. But what does the middle way mean? The middle way means you need to be aware. It's important. I think the athlete is quite aware that when he goes into a performance, he's relying on the fact that this is a trained habit. This particular habit may or may not always be useful. Sometimes you need a different habit. And we're not always aware when we're doing it unskillfully that it's a habit. You know, we fall into letting people push our buttons. We fall into that. So I want you to think about this, and what I would like you to do is take the statement of when I react to a situation or person based on past experience or by judging appearance, and that'll let you fill in the blank, and I'll give you a couple examples, one on the positive and one on the negative side. When I react to a situation on past experience, I can be more effective because I take advantage of what I've already learned. It's the positive side of it. Or, when I react to a situation based on past experiencing by judging appearances, I lose the chance to see my world from outside of the box and from a novel point of view, a negative side of doing it. So, what I'd like you to do is just go ahead and think about it. Think about, as you go around the circle, think back to experience times when you have just reacted without necessarily thinking things through or being aware. And what did that feel like? And what effect did it have on you? And then if, you know, nothing comes, take some time, just go around. We'll just do that for probably about 10 minutes, and then we'll come back and see how it feels. So why don't you split up? How many people? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, about 13 people. So why don't you go in either groups of three? I think there'll be one group of four, and then we'll just do that for about 10 minutes. So why don't you just take groups of people that are close to you so that we don't have to rearrange the room too much here. There's going to be one group of four. It's not a problem because we're just going to do this popcorn style, so you're just going to come up with one statement and go on to the next person anyway. So it doesn't really matter how many people we've got. So, okay, the sentence that we're working is when I react to a situation or person based on past experience or judging appearances, and just pick something positive or negative, think back and try and pick up something that you've done, like the examples I gave, complete it, and then go to the person. It doesn't have to make sense to the other people. Mainly has to make sense to you, because what I'm really, again, asking you to do is look inside yourself, see what your reaction is. Can you come up with an experience where you reacted that way, and how did it affect you? Okay? So go ahead, and in about 10 minutes, I'll... So, did anyone learn anything from that exercise? Was it useful? Not useful? I'd like to hear from some people. We're up here. We don't get necessarily to hear all the wonderful comments you guys are making. So, anyone want to take the risk and tell me how they thought it? Yeah.
I just found that most of the things that would arise were negative habits.
Mm-hmm. Why? I'm curious as to why they're... I agree with you. Usually what happens to me, and I wonder if it's because that's where our culture teaches us to go, towards the negative side of habits, or because, those are just the strongest ones where they... And that's what draws our attention to them. I don't know.
That could be.
Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
Well, I think in our group, pretty homogenous in that a lot of the things that the habits mm-hmm. have to do with self-protection,
mm-hmm.
Have to do with not having fear, have fear of the unknown. They serve us in a certain manner,
mm-hmm.
but they also leave out aspects of life that could be also serving us that we're not allowing.
Mm-hmm.
Which was interesting.
Yeah, I would agree. Do you also think it's partially for a matter of efficiency? We live such busy lives and so forth that habits are shortcuts to get us through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyone else have any comments? Well, I hope it gave you some insight into yourself and into what you're doing. We're going to take a break, if you need to use the restroom or stretch or whatever else, we can do that. And we'll come back at about 5 minutes to, so about 10-minute break, something like that. And I will let G take over with his part.
Are we all here? Okay, great. Welcome back. For those of you who don't know me, let me get my microphone. How's this? Can you hear me all right? Not too loud? Okay, sounds... You can hear my voice out there. Interesting. yeah, my name is G. Schultz. I'm part of one of the community teachers here. And I did a search for the... is that me? To stop breathing, huh? How's this? Okay, let's try this, see how it works. Yeah, I was talking with Jim, we did right intention together, so that was the second fold. So that would have been four folds ago. And here we are with wise view. No.
Effort.
No. No, I think I got the right one here. So, right effort. Yeah, this is one of the folds that I particularly sort of appreciate or like working with. I feel like it's a place where many of the folds kind of come together and a little bit where the rubber hits the road, where the practice actually can come to life. I actually titled this talk, Bringing Our Practice to Life. As I'm sure you know by now, the gist of right effort is essentially cultivating wholesome qualities to arouse them, to sort of bring them into one's life, and to help sustain them, maintain these qualities. And then on the flip side, we work with those qualities that are not so wholesome, our negative qualities, that we try to keep them from arising if they haven't arisen already. But of course, most of the time we're playing catch up. You know, they're here, and so we're working with how to abandon that quality, or at least kind of maybe reduce it a little bit so it's not quite such a problem. So in some ways it's quite simple, just cultivating the good and abandoning the evil or the unwholesome. It sounds very simple, but as we know, in our lives, it's more complicated than that. But the beauty of this practice is that the Buddha has put together this path, this eightfold path, and the different folds of this path, we'll see over time how they support each other. I think right effort is one of those folds where the others, you can see how they will come in and interplay with each other. Is it still doing a lot of breathy stuff? Is it better now? Okay. So I'll just start with the cultivating wholesome qualities piece. This is something you're already doing. Hopefully you're aware of it, but I actually had to think about this, wholesome qualities. With our right intention, we were introduced to the Brahma Viharas, to loving kindness practice, to compassion. With renunciation, you can look at it also as a generosity practice. So these are wholesome qualities, right? And I think for many of you, you're familiar with metta practice, and maybe it's something that you do at home. So I say this just to remind us that we are doing the work of arousing wholesome qualities. It's something that is sort of inherent in this practice and certainly inherent in the path. So sometimes we just need to remember and remind ourselves that, yeah, we're doing this work. And perhaps even reflect on, you know, how it's showing up in our life. If we've been on this path for a while, it's considered an incremental path, so usually there's not like a huge aha or your life just, you know, turns around, you know, on a dime. But over time, we can start to see how, as Jim was saying, how maybe more sukha, more goodness is showing up in our life, and maybe our dukkha is decreasing. So little by little, by creating the conditions for this, the conditions for less suffering, and the conditions for that lead to more happiness. So the other part, you know, a big part, and it's interesting because this fold you'll be going into more detail after right effort is the mindfulness. But of course, I'm sure everybody has, you know, meditation practice or some experience with meditation, which is, you know, essentially a mindfulness practice. And it's such, mindfulness is such a key element to this practice, because if we're not paying attention to what we're doing, we're working in ignorance, not seeing what's going on, what we're doing. If we notice what's going on, even if it's not good stuff, maybe even especially when it's not the good stuff that we're doing, now we know what's going on and we have the opportunity to work with it, to change it. Our guiding teacher, Bob Stahl, often has said that it's better to know that you're doing evil, that you're doing harm, than to be ignorant, to not know that you're doing it. If you know, then you can take action to remedy that, to do the wholesome and to abandon the unwholesome. So wisdom counters the ignorance, and it's, you know, a key part of this path. And mindfulness allows us to see more clearly what is going on. And what I think is so interesting is that there's the more, I guess, gross forms of the way we are in the world, which some of that shows up in the precepts, you know, like, you know, don't kill, don't steal, you know, guard, you know, around your sexuality and drugs, things like that. They're a little more coarse in some ways, you know, like most of us are probably not going around killing people. We might need to look at, you know, insects and our diet, you know, and how that impacts the world. So that can get more refined. But I think part of the beauty of mindfulness is that it starts to point to those more subtle things. You know, when we sit for half an hour or 45 minutes, we're noticing what is going on in our minds, the kinds of thoughts that are arising, noticing our attitudes, our feelings, and hopefully noticing how it affects us. You know, if we're having negative thoughts, or, you know, if we're caught up in aversion or greed, that we're starting to see the suffering that goes along with that. You know, they're conjoined. You know, if you're living in the defilements, the suffering goes right along with it. You know, you can't, you know, separate greed and suffering from each other. You can't separate hate and suffering. They're like together, like this. And the more we look at, the more we can see the more subtle forms. I know for myself, I used to think that I could have thoughts and get away with it because nobody could hear my thoughts. But I can hear my thoughts. I know what's going on. And I can see how it impacts how I am with other people. You know, if I'm thinking bad thoughts about you, and then when I see you, like, oh, hi, how are you? Those thoughts are there. They're there in the interaction. It creates a field, right? We usually can tell when somebody, they're putting on a face, but you can tell they're, you know, they have some feelings towards you that aren't good. On the other side of that, when we do metta practice for family and sometimes for, you know, our friends and also difficult people, how that changes the field as well. We're creating wholesome qualities, wholesome thoughts. And then when we maybe run across somebody, I've had this experience where somebody who maybe I've had difficulty with, done some metta for them, and then I run across them, and it's like, I'm almost like glad to see them. Maybe I am glad to see them. I have a warm feeling towards them. And then I'm like, wow, that's amazing. So our thoughts matter. And mindfulness is one of those ways that we can watch our thoughts and discern between wholesome thoughts and the unwholesome thoughts. So part of this, I feel like, is one is just trying to be mindful as much as we can in our life. It's not an easy task, but the more we do this practice, I think the more it starts to set in. And there's little things we can do, you know, like what's sometimes referred to as the sacred pause, where, you know, maybe several times in the day we will just stop and, you know, just kind of drop into our body, maybe just watch our breathing for a little bit, feel sensations, but just kind of put things down and like, what's going on? And part of that, if you have the time, is maybe a little bit of an inquiry, you know, like, how am I doing? How's my heart? You know, what's going on here? My body. And I think a great question is there some suffering going on here? Sometimes when we're feeling annoyed or irritated or, you know, that little bit out of sorts, worked up, usually those are forms of suffering. And if we sit down with that, one, we get to know that suffering. We start to become more sensitive to these more subtle forms. But then we can also start to work with that. We can think, what's behind that? Or what's going on? What can I do to maybe change this thinking pattern or this feeling I have? So it's just becoming more aware, more mindful of our mind states, and with a little inquiry, you know, is this wholesome, unwholesome? Is there suffering going on here? Or maybe I'm feeling some joy. Maybe it's a wholesome quality that's coming up. And the more awareness we have about this, I think the more ability we'll have to start to shift towards the wholesome side of the equation and abandon some of the unwholesome. And the beautiful part about it, it becomes visceral. We can just get that body sense that when we do the wholesome, we feel better, right? We feel better in ourselves, and we notice that the world, you know, feels better, friendlier. We're creating a nice field or energy that is palpable. You know, other people pick up on this as well. And on the other side, if we're, you know, if there's a lot of negativity going on and aversion, and that doesn't feel good for us, and most likely the people that we're interacting with are going to pick up on that as well. So it can be a very nice feedback loop where it tends to pull us towards the wholesome. You know, Gilbert Fronsdale talks about the Dharma being onward leading, and sometimes there's an analogy of a river that is flowing to the ocean, and that once you're really on the path of the Dharma, you're in that flow, and you're just little by little going to the ocean. I guess the ocean is maybe nirvana or the, you know, great happiness, but it starts to carry you along. And I love that notion. Maybe we have to paddle a little bit so we don't, you know, run to the shore or something like that. We need to do a little steering. But we're on the path. You know, the Eightfold Path can be seen as this river that's gently flowing to the ocean, you know, of nirvana or wholesomeness. So part of, I don't know if you read Bhikkhu Bodhi's piece, but there's a lot of information in there. It can be a little overwhelming, I think. But one piece that I appreciate is that he talks about the hindrances, and there are techniques where you can basically substitute, you know, for example, aversion, you substitute loving kindness for that. The idea being that you can't sort of both hate and love at the same time. And so that's one technique, you know, where we bring in the wholesome quality that we use to substitute for unwholesome. But I think, let's see if there's anything else I want to say here. So basically, just to reiterate what I've said, is that this right effort brings in the fold of mindfulness. You know, mindfulness is so important here. Brings in right view, in the sense that we become more attuned to suffering, you know, where suffering is showing up in our lives, the causes of the suffering, and the cessation of suffering. So that's all in the right view, and we become, how do we say, we penetrate that teaching, the Four Noble Truths. We give it in a more visceral level, you know, in our bodies, versus just, you know, the cognitive place. And that's where the teachings really become alive, when we know them for ourselves instead of just as a nice concept, you know. And then this process of inquiry, you know, of investigation, which I think is the factors of enlightenment, where we actively, you know, sort of go into something and see, you know, is there suffering here? Is this wholesome, unwholesome? What action might I take? So I'd like to talk a little bit about what I'll call practice opportunities. And what I'm referring to here is those moments when we find ourselves caught up in negativity, caught in one of our mental habits that doesn't serve us. And you know, as Jim talked about, as we've talked about here, that we are creatures of habit, right? The habits do serve us. They're kind of like shortcuts for things. You know, if we had to essentially reinvent the wheel for every situation, we'd be totally bogged down. So you know, having, you know, things kind of set up can serve us quite well. But I think, as we all know, many of these habits, they're kind of outdated, outmoded. Originally, maybe they arose as a form of protection, as a way to care for ourselves, maybe when we were like 5 or 6 years old. But they're not working so well now as adults. You know, a lot of these keep us stuck. We think they keep us safe, but they're actually limiting us, what we can do. And in many cases, they're not wholesome. They involve aversion, you know, fear, greed, you know, I'm going to get mine, you know, make sure I have all the hand sanitizer in Santa Cruz so that I'm going to be clean, you know. And we're seeing it act out, right? Yeah, me, mine. So I call these practice opportunities, because these are places that we can use our practice to rework that. And I often, one of my great practice opportunities that I go to all the time is around driving. I have a car, and, you know, use the car to get around, and I have found that the car driving is a great way for me to get in touch with my negative thinking patterns. you know, I'm in a hurry to go someplace, and the person in front of me is going slow, and I can get really upset with that person because they're going slower than I want to be going. And why are you going so slow? You know, I need to get somewhere. And a lot of negativity starts to arise. And I was even thinking that, you know, if they were looking in the rearview mirror at me, they'd probably see this scrunched up face, you know, like, oh, get out of my way. And I mean, the most obvious thing is it doesn't feel good for me, you know, to have this energy that, you know, I'm feeling towards somebody else and I'm late and all this stuff. And it's also an energy that goes out in the world, you know, this whole thing of road rage, you know, where people are, you know, honking and, you know, driving not very friendly, and maybe even dangerously, perhaps. So for me, it's a great opportunity to be with this pattern that's developed over so many years, you know, all the years I've been driving. And it gets pretty set. But seeing that, this is an opportunity where I can now bring in metta, you know, I can, instead of, you know, thinking what a jerk this person is that's going so slow or driving obliviously, I can bring, compassion and loving kindness, like, I wonder how they're doing, if they're okay, I wonder what's going on in their life, I could wish them that they'd be healthy and happy and safe, and just, you know, basically bring in these wholesome qualities, it changes the whole dynamic. It changes the whole feeling in myself, and I think changes, you know, what I'm putting out there in the world. You know, I start becoming more friendly with other drivers, with pedestrians, allowing people to, you know, to walk in front of me in the crosswalk, you know, like, please. Allowing people to come into the roadway, you know, when they're waiting in the parking lot and trying to get in. And so it creates a nice energy versus the negative. So for me, that's kind of an obvious place where I can substitute wholesome activity, wholesome qualities for the more negative, the aversive stuff that might be more habitual. And little by little, it starts to shift, it starts to change. So we'll go into this a little bit more in the breakout session, but I would encourage you to think about your own patterns and on both sides of it. One, you know, I mentioned about cultivating wholesomeness, and I know every person in this room, you know, does that. You wouldn't be here if you weren't interested in cultivating wholesome qualities and, you know, within yourself and how you are in the world, how you relate to your family, friends, and, you know, the larger world. So it's good to reflect on that, to remember that, you know, that you are on a path, you're here for a reason, and that is wholesome, you know, that you, if you look back to whenever you maybe first started meditating or getting more engaged with this practice, you might see how some changes have occurred over this period of time that you've been practicing. So it's good to reflect on that, to notice what's happened. And it's uplifting, and it encourages us on the path. You know, like, oh yeah, something is happening. Day to day, we don't always see it, but if we've been practicing for a while, you know, we can think back a few years ago how you might have reacted when somebody said something to you that you didn't like, and maybe how you would react today. It might be a little different today. Yeah, maybe more wholesome and more equanimity there. And then on the other side, you know, I'm sure we're not, probably not many of us are enlightened yet at this point. We still got our stuff we're working with. And so it's good to be aware of that. It's really good to be aware of that. It's not always pleasant to see those sides of ourselves. But again, like I mentioned, if we're in ignorance around that, if we don't see it, then it's going to keep going on. But when we start paying attention to it, and especially when we start noticing the suffering that is involved with that, then we can start to change, and we have the motivation to change, because nobody likes to suffer. We really don't, even, you know. I mean, sometimes we think like, oh yeah, I'm the biggest martyr in the world, but that gets old after a while. It really does. It's like, we all want to have a happy life, right? So, it's about that time where we're going to do breakout sessions again. And again, let's do groups of three with one group of four. And I would encourage you to mix it up a little bit so that you have some different people in your group. So, why don't we take a couple of minutes to find your group. And like I said, try to find somebody that definitely wasn't in your group before, and maybe somebody in this group of people that you don't know as well, perhaps, that you haven't got to know so well. Okay, so please form your groups. We're going to do it a little bit different than the first breakout session. I have two questions that I'm going to go by you, and we'll do one at a time. And for this, we're going to, each person, let's see, we'll do 2 minutes a person, and the group of three, you'll have a little extra time to just talk amongst yourselves. But I'll go ahead and time it, and so I'll ring the bell, and when 2 minutes is up, we'll have a little bit of silence, and then go on to the next person. So the first round, what I'd like us to do is think about something, some habit or quality that is, you know, maybe considered to be negative or not so skillful, unwholesome, whatever the word is for you, but something that is not serving you. And I would encourage you to go with something, not the most awful thing in your life, you know, just, you don't have to go there, okay? But something that is, it shows up a lot. You know, it could be just the annoyance when your partner, you know, the way they eat their food or something, and you have this thought like, you know. I mean, something simple like that, just that negative thought that just gets triggered like that. So see if you can come up with something, and then share if there's some way that right effort can help with this. Maybe it's something you're already doing, you know, maybe you have a meta practice that you try to bring up when you're in that negative thought, or feel compassion, or some other wholesome response. Or maybe you're struggling with it, maybe you just need to kind of air it out a little bit, and in that, putting it out there, that could be helpful, maybe something will come out of that. But we'll, each person will have 2 minutes. Are there any questions about this part of the exercise, this question? Okay. So, can you do another 2 minutes? Okay, great. So why don't you decide who will go first? Everybody got somebody? And then I'll ring the bell, and you go ahead and start. And I'll ring it again at the end of 2 minutes, and then if you just kind of quiet down before we start the next person. All right? To shift to the second question, and you might have already guessed this, but the second one is going to be about wholesome qualities, and let you think about what wholesome qualities that you're cultivating in your life through your practice, you know, however you go about doing it. Practice may be an obvious place, and maybe, you know, taking stock what your wholesome qualities are, you know. What you put out in the world, you know, your gifts, as they were, right? This could also be what wholesome qualities you'd like to work on, if maybe they're not quite up to snuff, or maybe, you know, it's a place you feel a little deficit. You could talk about that. And if you find this difficult, talking about your good qualities, take note of that. You know, it's sometimes, I don't know, in this culture, talking about, you know, what's good about ourselves is we're a little, it's much easier to talk about how we fall short. But it is wholesome to talk about our wholesomeness too, I think. So we're going to do a little more time, 2.5 minutes per person. And so feel free to do the wholesome, and, you know, if you want to go back to something from the previous question, you know, of course, feel free to. So you can begin again, maybe with the first person, or, you know, if you want to change it up, feel free, but you can start with the first to keep it simple, and we'll start. Oh, were there any questions? I'm sorry, any questions on that? Okay, all right, please start. Okay, I hope that was helpful or interesting or illuminating or not too painful. I don't know. You know, whatever came up, you know, is what came up, of course. So this is the period where we have 10 to 15 minutes of just general questions, answers, comments. Of course, we could start, like, if there's anything from this exercise that came up, a question or comment or a little insight, please feel free to share that, and we'll move on to anything around this fold of right effort, or what we talked about earlier today, or, you know, what might be up for you. So I'd like to open it up to you guys, whatever's on your minds, hearts.
I think one thing that came out is was so refreshing and still makes me smile is that the sentence starts out something like, well, the good thing about the coronavirus, you know, one thing to do, the good thing about the coronavirus, but we were talking about how this is the time where you need to take care of yourself. You need to think about what you're eating and how can you, what improvements in your lifestyle can you make to eat correctly, to get rest so that you know, are less of a target for coronavirus, you know, and to think, you know, it's just a different way of thinking about the virus, and I work with students, so I think that's more of the teaching and the lesson than, the coronavirus, it's how are you taking care of yourself?
Yeah. I appreciate you bring that up, the coronavirus. I mean, of course, it's just everywhere, and it was something I thought about when I was thinking about today. But right effort, it's a perfect place to work with the right effort. What can we do that's wholesome, that's helpful? Start that. Okay. What's helpful with this situation, with this crisis, and what's not helpful? So I think these teachings, they're very applicable, and not only what's, you know, helpful and wholesome for yourself, but of course how it impacts our community, our friends, family, and outward from there. So yeah, it's a great practice opportunity. Yeah.
I also kind of see it as an opportunity to look at what I was talking about earlier too, about building, how you build your world and how you live in it. One of the things I've been noticing about this coronavirus too is, if you look at people are getting sick and it's a real problem, and then yet we have a lot of people who run around, won't take flu vaccines or anything else, and yet what is there supposed to be? There's supposed to be many, many more people that are dying every year from the flu virus. So you see how, you know, we're used to having the flu around us, so we're not quite so afraid of it, or we're even contemptuous of it. And this new one, we're so unused to it, we can become fearful of it. And yet this the actual numbers out there are telling a different story than what's happening inside of my head. I'm afraid of the thing that I'm not used to, so I'm building that fear. Mm-hmm. It's my construction is doing it. And so for me, that's a practice opportunity to see how I do these things to myself, how our media does it to us, how all of this is ourselves constructing this world we live in.
I'm curious in looking at what we might call unwholesome qualities or negative habits. Did people get any insight or help about what they are or how to work with them? Does it seem to be helpful or useful in your life?
How do you feel, I'm just curious, this is, because this is something I've dealt with myself, how do you feel about the whole idea of intentionally deciding what you're going to feel and think and have as mind states? You know, some people think that doing this is kind of inauthentic, or too disciplined, or various other things. So there's lots of attitudes you can bring to this idea of, I'm going to get rid of those negative mind states, I'm going to intentionally create the positive mind states, and how that affects your sense of self. Does anybody have any feelings about that? Yeah.
It's something I've been thinking a lot about. It feels radical mm-hmm. to me. Because in the context of feelings coming and thoughts coming up in relationship to other people, so I don't have control over those other people and what they might say to me or what their experience. I'm thinking my family, my children, my husband, my extended family. They're all living their lives and stuff is happening, and sometimes it affects me, and all of that, you know, it's all possibility mm-hmm. for these feelings and thoughts to rise up in me, and to step back and say, I don't have to go down that path. Let's say, as a mother, mm-hmm. I don't have to go down that path of getting in a panic because my child is in some kind of crisis. It's freeing. It feels radical. It's yeah. fascinating.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of the reaction I've had to it, too. That's why I was asking, is because to see what extent that type of feeling is shared. Because it can, for sometimes it seems to me radical, and sometimes to me it almost seems inauthentic, but I don't think it is inauthentic. I think it's just a different way of viewing what you're doing, but that twinge is there present to me, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was saying, one of the things that's starting this whole process. Initially, when it rubbed me the wrong way, is potential lack or losing my own personality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about our society and what we value in interacting with other people is usually kind of a quick repartee.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't a pause, and there isn't thoughtfulness, mm-hmm. and you end up saying stuff. Maybe don't really mean to say. And it changes the dynamics of interactions with people who are not in this environment.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of makes it interesting. And I fall into, you talked about bad habits, I fall into that, those bad habits again of just responding, you know, and not taking a break or pausing and mm-hmm. trying to assess how I feel and what I want to say with intention.
I think it's empowering to know that we can change our thoughts or mind states and behaviors. You know, what I hear a lot, you know, from you know, people in my family and elsewhere. It's like, oh, that's just the way I am. You know, I'm a negative person, or I'm this way, or I'm that way. And what I think, I'm like, well, you don't have to be that way. You know, just to resign to that. Like, there's a lot of, you know, like I think, like, you know, in this practice, we have a lot of, there's so many tools that we have that we can, we can mold ourselves to being somebody, you know, who is, you know, happy and accepting and non-judgmental, and, you know, however we want to cultivate our personality. And I think it's really empowering, and I feel like so many people in society don't realize that that's a possibility, because they just feel like that's just, they're just stuck the way they are.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a path of liberation. Yeah.
For me, I think it's a really positive assessment to take a look at, like, for me, my own habits and what brought me to those habits. And the practice of being, of realizing that I could be open-minded and consider that there are other options. And so that kind of for me goes back into wise view, wise intention, you know, kind of going back to sort of the beginning of the path. Because knowing that there are other options is so helpful to not feel stuck. But yet when you're going along in life and stuff happens, and then you like do it the way you always do it, and then you're like, oh, if you don't stop and pause and think about it, really assess it, get stuck, and then you forget, oh, I forget, I could be open-minded. Oh, there are lots of options and other ways of seeing this and responding to this, or you know, gravitating toward other practices. So it's very helpful to me to even have that in consciousness, you know, letting it enter in.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I think it's, to me, it's been very empowering too. I agree. It's makes all the difference in being able to choose what I want to do. I think that's my way around it, being inauthentic, is the choice of what to do is mine in the end. So, but I have to, as I say, I have to be able to see what I'm doing now in order, and what my options are if I'm going to be able to do it, which is why, as she was saying, mindfulness is so important to this.
For me, it comes down to suffering and wanting to avoid suffering. Years ago, when I started working with anger, which is a very dominant negative quality in my makeup, what I noticed was that when I expressed my anger outwardly toward the other person I was angry with, that it not only created suffering in the other person, but it also created suffering in me, because for several days afterwards, then I would feel negative about myself. Oh, I really blew it. I got angry and regret and down on myself. And it was, you know, I'd do that for a few days before that kind of wore off. And so it came down for me to, I want to avoid suffering. Anger creates suffering, so if I want to avoid it, I better avoid getting angry. And so then I started to, you know, work on how do I work with anger? And as anybody who has worked with anger knows, it takes a while.
Yeah.
And it's maybe an ongoing process, but anyway, it had to do for me around suffering and wanting to avoid creating suffering, but not only that, but suffering within myself.
Yeah. I think that question, like, do my thoughts, actions, words, are they creating suffering or lessening suffering? I think it's a great litmus test to,
really,
like, am I going the right way? Is this going, is wholesome or unwholesome?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, are there any other burning questions we need to deal with? If not, we've come up to the end of the day, and you'll have the entire month to work with the right effort, and then every one of you that has mentors will be able to meet with their mentors and talk about this one more time before we move on to mindfulness. So, any other burning questions? I don't want to you to walk out of here feeling you had to say something and didn't get the chance. Okay, then thank you for coming.
Thank you.
It's been a great meeting today.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.